The kitchen has been a place of oppression, but it's also a very safe space. I'm not that great at boundary setting in real life, but I'm like, no, you can't cook with me, or you can't come into my kitchen. And even in professional settings where I've worked in kitchens, I've kicked people out of the kitchen. I'm like, can you get out?
How do you self-define? How do you self-identify? How do you describe yourself as a human being?
Wow. Damn, Kristen. Okay, well, I think the first thing that pops into my head is obviously a book lover. I think it's probably the first identity. Identity is definitely a hard one for me. Chicana, Latina, Tejana. So someone's from Texas, Latina from Texas. Texas is super important to me. Someone from San Antonio, the very specific culture, and specifically someone from the west side of San Antonio. Gay is probably number three. I've definitely struggled with gender and used various identifiers. Identified as non-binary for a while, for a few years, and then thought I was trans masculine, and definitely think I'm on some sort of spectrum. But I think for political reasons, I just say female, I have to check that box. But I'd rather not. I'd rather just be a person. I love doing drag. It definitely is fun to be someone else or like explore different parts of yourself. I am a cook. I am a minister. I am a partner. I'm a friend. That's it. I think those are all the identities. My grandma specifically is Italian, and the rest of our family is Mexican and Mexican American. And so she's very Catholic, and so she'd take me to church with her. She was a Bible school teacher. So I have memories being a kid and going to her little class. Like before I was old enough to go to the school, she would just like take me. My mom kind of strongly identified at one point as like Buddhist. So she would constantly talk about and read like some like meditations and things that way. My dad used to be Hare Krishna when he was a young person. And so my dad specifically, he would use like various names for God, and he would tell me like various Hindu stories and different descriptions of God. And I'm very grateful for both of my parents' spirituality, because I was able to be free in spirituality in the sense that I could see God as multifaceted. When I started doing like ministry as like a younger person, teenager, college, starting to talk to people who were really only raised in the Catholic Church or only raised in the Christian Church, where they were very much told like who God was, and God's very, you know, God's like a white man, and God's either very loving or very angry, but there's very specific identities that God has. And it's only that, versus that God has all these different identities. God's very fluid and is as fluid as like as humans are. Like there's just all of us represent God. And I think that really frames like how I interact with people and how I interact with the world, because I was also taught that, you know, God is trees and God is plants and rocks and water, and I have this respect for the planet and this like need to protect the planet.
Was your grandmother, was her Catholicism more conservative, or was it more mystical?
I'm not too sure, because so she's Italian. She's like her side of the family was on farms. And then her mom moved to the city, but they were farm people. And so what I understand about, like in Mexican and Mexican American families that we have, non-Christian spirituality, she also had that. So there's some things, you know, when we talk about like the evil eye, very similar to the Mexican beliefs. There's different things that she would do and believe that weren't Christian, but she would never think that they're not because they're so embedded into her life. She's so wild. This one memory of that I'd go with my grandmother obviously every Sunday, probably until I went to college because I started going to a different church. She likes to speak while the priest is speaking. So particularly like during the rituals when the priest is blessing the bread and the wine, and she knows the word. So she's saying, like, everyone's silent and my grandma is saying the word. And I was like, Grandma, you can't say the words. Like, if the priest is talking. Because, you know, people are looking at her and they're like, what's wrong with this old lady? And she's what? I'm a priest. And I was like, who am I to tell you not to be part of this ritual like that? That was really beautiful to me because I, as a very young person, I was probably, I think, 8 years old, because that's when I got First Communion. I had told like the deacon of the church that I was going to be a priest, told me I couldn't. And so since then, I was very angry and always wanted to be a priest. And here's my grandmother. She's not angry. She's just like, I already am a priest. No one has to ordain me or tell me, give me any training. Like, I'm here. I'm part of this. Thing that I've been like thinking about and something I want to create as like my theological work is something that I call like cocina theology, like kitchen theology, and it's centered around women and femmes. It's not just women but femmes who are in the kitchen. Obviously not only women and femmes are in the kitchen, but it's traditionally women and femmes, and I've only been in the kitchen with women and femmes. And so the kitchen for me is a sacred space, and that is where God is usually, and where God shows up or spirit shows up. And from a very little age, you know, I've watched the women in the family interact with each other in the kitchen, because it was the kitchen where at my grandmother's that like my grandma and my mom and her sister would sit around, they would drink coffee and they would talk. And because the kitchen is the place where men weren't allowed, they could say whatever they wanted. Their husbands were not there. Their children were not there. I was there in the corner, but, you know, they would say stuff in front of me in the kitchen that they wouldn't say elsewhere, right? And so I heard all these tragic life stories, but also happy stories and all sorts of stories. Like, I think there's a lot of laughter in the kitchen, and there's crying and there's yelling and there's a lot of processing, and not just in the cooking process, but also in the eating process. It's a lot of sharing. And I think because I'm still very Catholic, and I think of communion, I think of sharing, not just sharing in communion with God, but sharing that communion with other people, but through stories, because stories are very important to me, but I see them, how they work in the world and how they can change people's lives. If you hear a certain story, it can change your point of view. Or if you're a kid and you hear certain stories, you know, it really can shape how you think. I've been very blessed. Like, I only really work with people in kitchen that I like, where I've had friends, you know, that I think I don't even put myself in that space of like, I may consider you a friend, but I wouldn't cook with you. You know, there's certain people that I'm like, nah, I wouldn't cook with you. And other people that, I don't know. There was this one coworker, because I worked at a kitchen also professionally, where we didn't have to speak. Like, there was one time we didn't speak to each other for an hour, and we had all these orders, and we were just knocking them out, and we were helping each other, and no one was talking. We were communicating without speaking. And I thought that was the most perfect form of communion in the kitchen that I could think of. Let me okay, let me say this. When people ask me, like, how do I community build? The way that I can do it personally, you know, what is the way to build community? And I would say cook a meal together and also eat together, like share that meal that you make. And people usually get the meal sharing part. I think, you know, we go to dinners and been to a lot of dinners, but it's also the cooking process because you get to know people real fast of like people's temperament, if they're like how they react to stress or how they, if they're super meticulous with shopping or if, you know what, they don't like doing simple tasks. They want to do something more difficult. Like you can know their personality. For me, that's where I experience God and spirit is moving in the kitchen. And specifically because the kitchen has also been a form of oppression for me and for a lot of other women and femmes. The kitchen has been a place of oppression, but it's also a very safe space. Because at some point that was the only place I was told I was supposed to be. But now as an older person, I can reclaim that space and have seen the sacredness of it and have chosen who can come into my kitchen. And that's not a metaphor, that's like a real kitchen because I'm not that great at boundary setting in real life. But I'm like, no, you can't cook with me or you can't come into my kitchen. And even in professional settings where I've worked in kitchens, I've kicked people out of the kitchen. I'm like, can you get out? So one thing that my grandfather on my dad's side left us was 100, like he gave us a recipe book that he wrote. And it's like 100 of his recipes. So I like reprinted a few of them. There's maybe 20 recipes that I printed. And the way I reprinted them because the way he wrote it, it was like he was leaving it not just for his family, but for somebody to read, like other than us. But his note at the beginning, like he wrote in really big letters, keep butter in freezer at all times. Just really big letters. And I thought that was hilarious. And in his recipe book, he also has stories in there. They're not just recipes. Like he talks about a time where, because he was a veteran of Korea, and he talks about how they went for 2 weeks, like they had run out of rations and they didn't have any food. They'd hardly eat, like they'd skip a few days and then they'd eat something. And that they went to this one clearing and there was a bread truck that was giving out bread to the troops, and it was the French bread. And they were each allowed, I think it was like a loaf or it was like 2 loaves. And because he put them in his pocket. So I think it was 2. He put the loaves in his back pockets. And he ate like half of it there. And that, you know, that was such a powerful story to me of like that he related. Because he'd always talk about the war. Like he was one of the grandfathers that you come in and he's talking about the war. But he would talk to my dad about it. So he never shared these food stories with him. And so it was important to have this food memory of that with him, where he's like, that was one of the happiest moments of his life, where cause he didn't have any food and he was in this terrible situation where, yes, he volunteered to go and he went very young as soon as he could sign up because like he would help pick spinach. You know, there were migrant workers and he worked at grocery stores. He'd work at wherever he could find work. So as soon as he could, he went into the war because they had better benefits. Like they were promised Mexican kids, Mexican American boys, they'd be able to come back and they'd have a house and they could go to school if they wanted, you know. And so that's why he was there. To hear stories, my grandfather, when he worked at grocery store, like the snack that they all ate at the grocery store was crackers, anchovies, cheese, and mustard, and that was like their dinner. So all these food memories are also associated like with groups of people. So that one, he talks about the boys that he worked with at the grocery store, and he talks about the military story of the men that were with him in that group. Like it was a communal experience. He talks about him and my grandmother arguing about the recipes, about his recipes were better. He's like, my recipes are better than yours. You don't add enough butter. So I think it's also good to understand like that there's sometimes contention in the kitchen, even with people that you love. There was a time when I moved to Denver and I was away from my community in San Antonio and I had his recipes with me. So I'd make specific like enchilada salsa that he made and put it, you know, for enchiladas. And to have him in my kitchen when he's no longer alive, but to be able to have his food there and have that connection with home was very special. So I think when we think of sacred, I think we think like it always has to be happy and always has to be a super positive space. But sometimes it's also very dark. And I always have been attracted to the very sad, and probably because I'm Catholic, very sad parts of the spirituality. But in that sadness, like God's still there, that that's still spirit. I mean, you will see me in my work kitchen crying while I'm washing dishes or chopping vegetables. I'm always crying. And it's not about the work. It's about childhood traumas that come up while you're cooking. And I kind of just acknowledge them. And I've been able to work through stuff in the kitchen. And that's also how I see it as sacred, because it's like, was that a positive experience? No. But did it yield really good fruit? Yes. Specifically when I was in undergrad and I was taking religion theology classes, I had a teacher who was like, you can't write about other people's experiences. You have to write about your own experiences. And while I agree with that, I think that we have to have space for inherited stories. So like, no, we shouldn't be speaking for a community that's not our own. But these people are my community. And I'm not speaking for them, but I'm speaking with them. There's something about when we talk about like inherited trauma, like, yes, I heard these stories, but there's also before I heard it, I inherited physically their stories. And people often say like, no, when you hear a story, you're rehearing a story. You already have it in your DNA, which is a very interesting way to think about it. But it feels true. Like when I hear a story, I'm like, I feel like I've heard this before, even if I never have. A lot of us spiritual folk are trying to recreate community on a massive scale. And so we'll see, obviously.
Thanks for listening to episode 16 of Bite-Sized Blessings, the podcast all about the magic and spirit that surrounds us, as long as we open our eyes to it. And whether you choose to listen to our bite-sized offerings for that 5 to 10 minutes of freedom in your day, or the longer interviews, we're grateful you're here. I need to thank Elvia Rendon for sharing her story today, as well as the creators of the music used, Taiga Sound Productions, Music L Files, Brian Holtz Music, Raphael Crux, Sasha End, Rommel Pro, Frank Schroeder, and Chilled Music. For complete attribution, please see the Bite-Sized Blessings website at bitesizedblessings.com. On the website, you can find links to other episodes, as well as to books, people, and music I think will lighten and brighten your day. Thanks for listening, and here's my one request. Be like Elvia. Find your sacred space, and then create love and community within it.